The Russians employed thousands of paid internet trolls and botnets to push out disinformation and fake news at a high volume, focusing this material onto your Twitter and Facebook feeds and flooding our social media with misinformation, he said. This fake news and disinformation was then hyped by the American media echo chamber and our own social media networks to reach and potentially influence millions of Americans, unquote. It gets worse. According to Time magazine, the Russians targeted propaganda to undecided voters and to soft Clinton supporters who might be persuaded to stay home or support a third-party candidate, including by purchasing ads on Facebook. It's against the law to use foreign money to support a candidate, as well as for campaigns to coordinate with foreign entities. So a commissioner on the Federal Election Commission has called for a full investigation of this charge. We know that swing voters were inundated. According to Senator Warner, quote, women and African Americans were targeted in places like Wisconsin and Michigan, unquote. One study found that in Michigan alone, nearly half of all political news on Twitter in the final days before the election was false or misleading propaganda. Senator Warner has rightly asked, quote, how did they know to go to that level of detail in those kinds of jurisdictions, unquote. Interestingly, the Russians made a particular effort to target voters who had supported Bernie Sanders in the primaries, including by planting fake news on pro-Sanders message boards and Facebook and amplifying attacks by so-called Bernie bros. Russian trolls posted stories about how I was a murderer, money launderer, and secretly had Parkinson's disease. I don't know why anyone would believe such things, even if you read it on Facebook. Although it's often hard to tell on there what's a legitimate news article and what's not, but maybe if you're angry enough, you'll accept anything that reinforces your point of view. As the former head of the NSA, retired General Keith Alexander, explained to Congress, the Russian goal was clear, quote, what they were trying to do is drive a wedge within the Democratic Party between the Clinton group and the Sanders group, and then within our nation between Republicans and Democrats, unquote. Perhaps this is one reason why third-party candidates received more than 5 million more votes in 2016 than they had in 2012. That was an aim of both the Russians and the Republicans, and it worked. According to CNN, Time, and McClatchy, the Justice Department and Congress are examining whether the Trump Campaign Data Analytics Department, led by Kushner, coordinated with the Russians to pull all this off. Congressman Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, has said he wants to know whether they, quote, coordinated in any way in terms of targeting or in terms of timing or in terms of any other measure, unquote. If they did, that also would be illegal. Think this is bad? There's more. We knew during the campaign that Russian hackers had breached election systems in two states. Now we know that this effort was far more extensive than previously thought. In June 2017, officials from the Department of Homeland Security testified before Congress that election systems in as many as 21 states were targeted. Bloomberg News reported that the number could be as high as 39. According to a leaked NSA report, the accounts of more than 100 local election officials across the country were also penetrated. In addition, hackers gained access to the software used by poll workers on Election Day. The goal of these intrusions seems to have been accessing voter registration information. Hackers attempted to delete or alter records of particular voters. They could also have used the data to better target their propaganda efforts. According to Time, investigators want to find out if any stolen voter information ended up with the Trump campaign. I know that the slow unfolding of this news has inured many people to how shocking all this is. It feels a little like the frog in the pot that doesn't realize it's boiling because it happens so gradually. But step back and think about it. The Russians hacked our election systems. They got inside. They tried to delete or alter voter information. This should send a shiver down the spine of every American. And why stop there? According to the Washington Post, the Russians used old-fashioned forgery to influence the election as well. The Post says Moscow surreptitiously got a fake document to the FBI that described a fabricated discussion between the chair of the Democratic National Committee and an aide to financier and liberal donor George Soros about how Attorney General Lynch had promised to go easy on me in the email investigation. It was a bizarre fantasy straight out of the fever swamp. James Comey may well have known the document was a forgery, but the Post says he was concerned that if it became public, it would still cause an outcry. Its existence, however fraudulent, provided him with a new justification to disregard long-standing protocol and hold his infamous July press conference disparaging me. I don't know what Comey was thinking, but the idea that the Russians could have manipulated him into such a damaging misstep is mind-boggling. Finally, to add one more bit of cloak-and-dagger mystery to this whole story, a lot of Russian officials seem to have had unfortunate accidents since the election. On election day itself, an officer in the New York consulate was found dead. The first explanation was that he fell off a roof. Then the Russians said he had a heart attack. On December 26th, a former KGB agent thought to have helped compile the salacious Trump dossier was found dead in his car in Moscow. On February 20th, the Russian ambassador to the United Nations died suddenly, also from a heart attack. Russian authorities have also arrested a cybersecurity expert and two intelligence officials who worked on cyber operations and accused them of spying for the United States. All I can say is that working for Putin must be a stressful job. If all this sounds unbelievable, I know how you feel. It's like something out of one of the spy novels my husband stays up all night reading. Even knowing what the Russians did in Ukraine, I was still shocked that they would wage large-scale covert warfare against the United States. But the evidence is overwhelming, and the intelligence community assessment is definitive. What's more, we know now that the Russians have mounted similar operations in other Western democracies. After the U.S. election, Facebook found and removed tens of thousands of fake accounts in France and the United Kingdom. In Germany, members of parliament have been hacked. Denmark and Norway say the Russians breached key ministries. The Netherlands turned off election computers and decided to count every vote by hand. And most notably, in France, Emmanuel Macron's campaign was hit by a massive cyber attack just before the presidential election that sparked immediately comparisons with the operation against me. But because the French had watched what happened in America, they were better prepared. Macron's team responded to Russian phishing attacks with false passwords, and they seeded fake documents in with their other files, all in an attempt to confuse and slow down the hackers. When a trove of stolen Macron emails did appear online, the French media refused to provide the kind of sensationalized coverage we saw here, in part because of a law in France that guards against that happening close to an election. French voters also seem to have learned from our mistakes, and they soundly rejected Le Pen, the right-wing pro-Moscow candidate. I take some comfort knowing that our misfortune helped protect France and other democracies. That's something at least. The War on Truth. As I noted at the beginning of this chapter, one reason the Russian misinformation campaign was successful was that our country's natural defenses had been worn down over several years by powerful interests that sought to make it harder for Americans to distinguish between truth and lies. If you feel like it's gotten tougher to separate out fringe voices from credible journalists, especially online, or you find yourself arguing more and more with people over what should be knowable facts, you're not going crazy. There has been a concerted effort to discredit mainstream sources of information, create an echo chamber to amplify fringe conspiracy theories, and undermine Americans' grasp of objective truth. The McClatchy News Service says federal investigators are looking into whether there were direct links between the Russian propaganda war and right-wing organizations such as Breitbart and InfoWars. But even if no direct ties ever come to light, we need to understand how the right-wing war on truth opened the door to the Russian attack. After the election, a former conservative talk radio host in Wisconsin named Charlie Sykes came forward to explain how this worked. For years, he said, right-wing media and politicians conditioned their supporters to distrust anything they heard from the mainstream media, while pushing paranoid conspiracy theories from people such as Alex Jones and Trump himself, the chief promoter of the racist birther lie. Quote, "The price turned out to be far higher than I imagined," Sykes said. "The cumulative effect of the attacks was to delegitimize the mainstream media and essentially destroy much of the right's immunity to false information," unquote. This was useful for Trump when he became a candidate because it helped him both deflect negative stories from mainstream sources and find a receptive audience for false attacks against me. It did the same for the Russians. And Trump has kept at it in the White House. Quote, "All administrations lie, but what we are seeing here is an attack on credibility itself," unquote, Sykes said. He quoted Garry Kasparov, the Russian chess grandmaster and Putin opponent, who said, quote, "The point of modern propaganda isn't only to misinform or push an agenda. It is to exhaust your critical thinking, to annihilate truth," unquote. Rupert Murdoch and the late Roger Ailes probably did more than anyone else to make all this possible. For years, Fox News has been the most powerful and prominent platform for the right-wing war on truth. Ailes, a former advisor to Richard Nixon, built Fox by demonizing and delegitimizing mainstream media that tried to adhere to traditional standards of objectivity and accuracy. Fox gave a giant megaphone to voices claiming climate change was fake science, the falling unemployment rate was phony math, and you couldn't trust Barack Obama's birth certificate. Ailes and Fox were so successful in polarizing the audience that by 2016, most liberals and conservatives got their news from distinctly different sources and no longer shared a common set of facts. During the Obama years, the Breitbart News Network, backed by Robert and Rebecca Mercer and led by their advisor, Steve Bannon, who is now Trump's top strategist, emerged to give Fox a run for its money. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, Breitbart embraces, quote, "ideas on the extremist fringe of the conservative right," unquote. To give you a flavor, here are a few memorable Breitbart headlines. "Birth control makes women unattractive and crazy." "There's no hiring bias against women in tech. They just suck at interviews." "Global temperatures plunge. icy silence from climate alarmists. NAACP joins Soros' army plotting D.C. disruptions, civil disobedience, mass arrests. Hoisted high and proud, the Confederate flag proclaims a glorious heritage. Fact check. Were Obama and Hillary founders of ISIS? You bet. This would be funny if it wasn't so scary. This kind of garbage conditioned Americans, to use Charlie Sykes's word, to accept the Russian propaganda that flooded our country in 2016. Robert Mercer is a key figure to understand. A computer scientist, Mercer made billions of dollars by applying complex algorithms and data analysis to the financial markets. The hedge fund he helps run, Renaissance Technologies, is wildly successful. By all accounts, Mercer is an extreme anti-government right-winger. A profile in The New Yorker quoted one former Renaissance colleague as saying Mercer is, quote, happy if people don't trust the government. And if the president's a bozo, he's fine with that. He wants it to all fall down, unquote. The New Yorker also reported that another former high-level Renaissance Technology employee said Mercer hates Bill and me, and once accused us of being part of a secret CIA drug-running scheme and of murdering our opponents. If you think these accusations sound batty, you're right, and this man is now one of the most powerful people in America. Breitbart is only one of the organizations Mercer and his family control. Another is Cambridge Analytica, which has gained notoriety for using Facebook data to target voters for clients such as Trump. It's hard to separate reality from hype when it comes to Cambridge Analytica's track record, but it seems like a mistake to underestimate Mercer. As The New Yorker put it, quote, having revolutionized the use of data on Wall Street, he was eager to accomplish the same feat in the political realm, unquote. There's nothing inherently wrong with using big data and micro-targeting. Every campaign does it, including mine. The problem would come if the data were obtained or used improperly. After reports were published raising questions about whether Cambridge Analytica played a role in Brexit, British authorities are now investigating the company's alleged role with leave.eu and whether Cambridge's techniques violated British and European privacy laws, which Cambridge denies. Mercer is not alone. The Koch brothers, who run the second largest privately held company in America with extensive oil and gas holdings, have also invested huge sums of money, which has eroded the public's grasp on reality and advanced their ideological agenda. For example, they've spent tens of millions of dollars to fund a network of think tanks, foundations, and advocacy organizations to promote the false science of climate change denial and their agenda. We can expect more of that as the Kochs prepare to spend whatever it takes to consolidate their hold on state governments and expand their power in Washington. And let's not forget Donald Trump himself. It took a little while for Mercer, the Kochs, and Fox News to realize that Trump could help take their war on truth to the next level, but their eventual support for his candidacy was invaluable. In many ways, Trump is the embodiment of everything they had been working toward and the perfect Trojan horse for Putin. The journalist, Masha Gessen, who covers Putin extensively, has observed, quote, it's not just that both Putin and Trump lie. It is that they lie in the same way and for the same purpose, blatantly, to assert power over truth itself, unquote. What now? In a Senate hearing in June 2017, Senator Angus King of Maine asked Jim Comey, quote, was the Russian activity in the 2016 election a one-off proposition, or is this part of a long-term strategy? Will they be back? Unquote. Quote, They'll be back, Comey replied emphatically. It's not a Republican thing or Democratic thing. It really is an American thing, unquote. He returned to the point a few minutes later, quote, we're talking about a foreign government that using technical intrusion, lots of other methods, tried to shape the way we think, we vote, we act. That is a big deal, and people need to recognize it, Comey said. It's not about Republicans or Democrats. They're coming after America, unquote. Comey is absolutely right about this. The January 2017 intelligence community report called the Russian influence campaign a new normal and predicted Moscow would continue attacking the United States and our allies. Given the success Putin has had, we should expect interference in future elections and even more aggressive cyber and propaganda efforts. Sure enough, since the election, there are new reports that Russia has launched cyber attacks against the U.S. military, including targeting the social media accounts of thousands of American soldiers, that hackers have penetrated companies that run American nuclear power plants, and that Russia is expanding its spy networks inside the United States. We should also expect the right-wing war on truth to continue. As Trump faces growing political and legal challenges, he and his allies will likely intensify their efforts to delegitimize the mainstream press, the judiciary, and anyone else who threatens his preferred vision of reality. Can anything be done to meet these twin threats and protect our democracy? The answer is yes, if we take this seriously. In 1940, a time of much greater danger for our country, the writer John Buchan wrote, quote, we have been shaken out of our smugness and warned of a great peril, and in that warning lies our salvation. The dictators have done us a marvelous service to remind us of the true values of life, unquote. Americans today need to be similarly alert and determined. Here are four steps that would help. First, we need to get to the bottom of what really happened in 2016. Investigators and the press should keep digging. Based on how things are going, it's possible that, as often happens in Washington scandals, the alleged cover-up will become the most serious legal and political problem facing Trump. But no matter what happens, the American people will still need to know the truth about what the Russians did. Therefore, I believe the special counsel investigation should be complemented by an independent commission with subpoena power like the one that investigated 9/11. It should provide a full public accounting of the attack against our country and make recommendations to improve security going forward. It's hard to understand how Republicans, so eager to set up a special committee to go after me over Benghazi, could block such a step. Second, we need to get serious about cyber warfare. Government and the private sector need to work together more closely to improve our defenses. It will require significant investments to protect our networks and national infrastructure, and corporate America needs to see this as an urgent imperative because government can't do it alone. At the same time, our military and intelligence agencies should accelerate development of our own offensive cyber and information warfare capabilities so that we are prepared to respond to aggression in kind if need be. Right now, we do not have an effective deterrent to prevent cyber and information warfare the way we do with conventional and nuclear conflicts. Russia, China, and others believe they can operate in a so-called gray zone between peace and war, stealing our secrets, disrupting our elections, manipulating our politics, and harassing our citizens and businesses without facing serious repercussions. To change that calculus, I believe the United States should declare a new doctrine that states that a cyber attack on our vital national infrastructure will be treated as an act of war and met with a proportionate response. Third, we need to get tough with Putin. He responds only to strength, so that's what we must demonstrate. It was gratifying to see Emmanuel Macron, the new French president, condemn Russian interference and propaganda while standing next to Putin at a press conference in Paris. If the French can do it, surely our own leaders can. Congress recently passed legislation over Trump's objections to ratchet up sanctions on Russia, and he reluctantly signed it. We should keep doing everything we can to isolate Putin. As former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said in May, quote, "I'm appalled by what the Russians did, and we ought to find a way ultimately to punish it," unquote. The Obama administration proved with crippling sanctions against Iran that this kind of pressure can force our adversaries to change course. Russia is a much bigger and more powerful nation, but we have a lot of tools at our disposal, and even Putin is vulnerable to pressure. We also should strengthen NATO, help our allies reduce their dependence on Russian energy supplies, a key source of leverage for Putin, and arm the Ukrainian government so it can resist Moscow's aggression. Fourth, we need to beat back the assault on truth and reason here at home and rebuild trust in our institutions. Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, has called for a massive campaign against fake news. Quote, "All of us technology companies need to create some tools that help diminish the volume of fake news," unquote, he said. Companies such as Facebook, Twitter, and Google have already begun taking steps, adjusting algorithms, deactivating bot networks, and partnering with fact-checkers, but they must do more. Facebook is now the largest news platform in the world. With that awesome power comes great responsibility, which it must accept. The mainstream media also has a responsibility to do more to debunk the lies infecting our public life and more directly hold the liars accountable. American journalists who eagerly and uncritically repeated whatever WikiLeaks dished out during the campaign could learn from the more responsible way the French press handled the hack of Macron. It will also be important to remain vigilant against misinformation like the fake leak that MSNBC's Rachel Maddow exposed in July 2017. Quote, "One way to stab in the heart aggressive American reporting on that subject is to lay traps for American journalists," unquote, she warned. And while there has been a lot of terrific reporting on the Russia scandal, we need to see the same rigor brought to the blizzard of deception from the administration and Republicans in Congress on everything from the budget to health care to climate change. I love it when CNN does real-time fact-checking in its on-screen chyron. More of that, please. Speaking of Republicans, ultimately it's on them to stop enabling Trump and genuflecting to billionaires such as the Mercers and the Kochs. Aggressive campaign finance reform and a reinvigorated federal election commission would help a lot. But unless principled Republicans step up, our democracy will continue to pay the price. We all have to do our part if we're going to rebuild trust in one another and our government. As Clint Watts, a former FBI agent and senior fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, put it in his testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, quote, "Until we get a firm basis on fact and fiction in our own country, we're going to have a big problem," unquote. It's up to each one of us to stay informed and make good decisions with rigorous reasoning and real deliberation. This is especially important when it comes to voting. Choose wisely and don't fall for scams. The same way you try to be careful about where you put your money or the car you buy, be careful and informed with your vote. And we all have the ability to break out of our echo chambers and engage with people who don't agree with us politically. We can keep an open mind and be willing to change our minds from time to time. Even if our outreach is rebuffed, it's worth it to keep trying. We're all going to share our American future together, Better to do so with open hearts and outstretched hands than closed minds and clenched fists. Worse than Watergate. As this story continues to unfold, there's a moment from the campaign that I keep replaying in my head over and over again. It was my third debate against Trump. He had just attacked me by quoting out of context a line from an email stolen by the Russians and released by WikiLeaks. The moderator, Chris Wallace of Fox News, was piling on as well. I thought the American people deserved to know what was really going on. The most important question of this evening, Chris, is finally, will Donald Trump admit and condemn that the Russians are doing this and make it clear that he will not have the help of Putin in this election, I said? Trump retreated to his usual pro-Putin talking points. Quote, he said nice things about me. If we got along well, that would be good, unquote. Then turning to me, he added, quote, Putin, from everything I see, has no respect for this person, unquote. Well, I fired back, that's because he would rather have a puppet as president of the United States. Trump seemed befuddled. Quote, no puppet, no puppet, you're the puppet, unquote, he stammered. I think about that line every time I see him on TV now. When he's yucking it up in the Oval Office with the Russian foreign minister and divulging classified information. When he's giving the cold shoulder to the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and other European allies. When he's lying through his teeth about Russia or anything else. No puppet, no puppet, you're the puppet. This man is President of the United States, and no one is happier than Vladimir Putin. In mid-July, as I was putting the finishing touches on this book, Trump met with Putin in Germany. He not only didn't challenge him publicly on interfering in our election, he actually floated the idea of a joint cybersecurity unit, which is a classic example of asking the fox to guard the henhouse. Then the news broke that Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, and Jared Kushner met in June 2016 with a Russian lawyer connected to the Kremlin who promised to provide damaging information about me and wanted to discuss easing the sanctions on Russia included in the Magnitsky Act. Donald Trump Jr. admitted all this. He was disappointed the dirt didn't pan out the way he'd hoped. You can't make this stuff up. I'm sure there's more to come, so stay tuned. I know some will dismiss everything in this chapter as me trying to shift blame for my loss in 2016. That's wrong. This is about the future. In the 19th century, nations fought two kinds of wars, on land and at sea. In the 20th century, that expanded to the skies. In the 21st century, wars will increasingly be fought in cyberspace. Yet our president is too proud, too weak, or too short-sighted to face this threat head-on. No foreign power in modern history has attacked us with so few consequences, and that puts us all at risk. I'm not saying this as a Democrat or as a former candidate. I'm saying this as someone who loves our country and will always be grateful for the blessings America has given to me and to the world. I'm worried. I'm worried about our democracy at home with lies and corruption threatening our bedrock values, institutions, and the rule of law. And I'm worried about the future of democracy around the world. Generations of far-sighted leaders on both sides of the Atlantic came together to build a new liberal order out of the ashes of World War II. They defended universal human rights, defied totalitarianism, and delivered unprecedented peace, prosperity, and freedom. As Americans, that is our inheritance. We should be proud of it, and we should protect it. But now, between Trump and Putin, all that is at risk. In June 2017, Jim Clapper was asked how the Russia scandal compared with Watergate. Quote, I lived through Watergate. I was on active duty then in the Air Force. I was a young officer. It was a scary time, he replied. I have to say, though, I think when you compare the two, Watergate pales, really, in my view, compared to what we're confronting now, unquote. I also lived through Watergate. I was a young attorney working for the House Judiciary Committee's impeachment inquiry into Richard Nixon. I listened to the tapes. I dug into all the evidence of Nixon's crimes. And I agree with Jim Clapper. What we are facing now, an attack on our democracy by our principal foreign adversary, potentially aided and abetted by the president's own team, is much more serious. In three words, I can sum up everything I've learned about life. It goes on. Robert Frost. Election night. The night of November 8th, 2016, started with me chasing my granddaughter and pretending to just miss catching her. Charlotte would squeal with glee and shout, "Again!" And I did it again. This went on for a while. It was almost enough to distract me from the television. My family and senior staff had gathered at the Peninsula Hotel in New York to watch the returns. I've always dreaded election nights. There's nothing left to do but wait. Hours earlier, in the pre-dawn darkness, we finished a final whirlwind campaign swing that took me from Pittsburgh to Grand Rapids, Michigan, to a massive rally in Philadelphia with the Obamas and Bruce Springsteen. Then to another rally in Raleigh, North Carolina, capped by a raucous late-night duet between Jon Bon Jovi and Lady Gaga. And finally back to Westchester, where a crowd of fired-up supporters met us on the tarmac, even though it was close to 4 a.m. I was exhausted, but happy and enormously proud of my team. Standing with Bill, Chelsea, Barack, and Michelle in front of tens of thousands of people at Philadelphia's Independence Hall was one of the high points of the entire campaign. The president hugged me and whispered in my ear, quote, "You've got this. I'm so proud of you," unquote. After a quick stop at home to shower and change, Bill and I voted at an elementary school in Chappaqua. People pulled out their cell phones to text friends or discreetly shoot photos of me getting ready to vote. I walked over to the table staffed by diligent volunteers and signed my name in the book of eligible voters. We joked about whether I had identification to prove I was really me. They didn't make me produce a photo ID, but many Americans would have to do so, and too many would be turned away that day. Campaigns are full of minor annoyances and major frustrations, but at the end of the day, it's inspiring to watch our democracy whir into action. When all the arguments are made and rallies are finished and TV ads have aired, it comes down to regular people lining up and having their say. I've always loved that quip from Winston Churchill about how democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. I still believe that, even when our system feels totally nuts. Electoral College, I'm looking at you. It's quite something to see your name on a ballot. After 20 months, 12 debates, and more speeches and town halls than I could count, it all came down to this. All over the country, 136 million people were going to look at my name and Donald Trump's name and make a decision that would shape the future of the country and the world. Before I could mark my ballot, a woman walked up and asked if I would take a selfie with her. There really are no boundaries for the selfie obsession. Not even the sanctity of voting is off limits. I told her I would be delighted to, as soon as I was finished voting. I filled in the bubbles by my name and the down-ballot candidates, walked the ballot over to the scanner, slid it in, and watched it disappear. I felt pride, humility, and nerves. Pride because I knew we had given everything we had. Humility because I knew the campaign would be the easy part. Governing in this contentious time would be hard. And nerves because elections are always unpredictable. Most of the polling and analysis looked positive. The day before, my chief pollster, Joel Benenson, sent me an encouraging report. He said I was leading Trump by 5 points in a direct head-to-head and by 4 points when third parties were factored in. Quote, "You're going to bring this home," unquote, Joel told me. Still, I knew our campaign faced hurricane-force headwinds thanks to Comey and the Russians. Anything was possible. Voting turned out to be the highlight of the day. When we arrived at the Peninsula Hotel in the late afternoon, the word was, things are looking good. The streets were clogged with police officers and Secret Service agents. Our hotel was just a block away from Trump Tower. Both candidates would be within a stone's throw from each other as the results came in. I tried to keep my head clear. Unlike my husband, who devours every exit poll and stray anecdote on election days, I didn't want to hear it. I'm not convinced the breathless reporting during the day is reliable. And why stress about something you can no longer do anything about? In a few hours, we would all know the outcome. For weeks, I had been carrying around heavy binders full of memos relating to the transition and the first decisions I would have to make as president-elect. There were cabinet secretaries to pick, a White House staff to hire, and a legislative agenda to begin working on with the Congress. I loved diving into the details of governing, but in the home stretch of the campaign, it was hard to focus on anything past Election Day. Late at night, I would set aside time before bed to read a transition memo or review a few resumes. Sometimes I'd fall asleep halfway through. Other times I'd get fired up and call my team with some idea or plan I wanted us to get ready to pursue on day one. On election day, with the campaign all but finished, I had a chance to think in earnest about the work ahead. It was exciting. The hundreds of detailed policies we had proposed over the past 20 months hadn't gotten the press attention they deserved, but they provided a solid foundation for getting right to work tackling the nation's problems. I decided that first out of the gate would be an ambitious infrastructure program to create jobs while improving our roads, rails, airports, ports, mass transit systems, and broadband networks. There was a good chance the Democrats would retake the Senate, but I expected to face a hostile Republican majority in the House. In theory, infrastructure should have bipartisan appeal, but we'd learned that partisanship could overwhelm everything, so outreach would have to start right away. The challenge went well beyond rounding up enough Republican votes to pass an infrastructure package. The election had further divided our country in troubling ways. Trust in government and in our fellow Americans was at historic lows. We were yelling at one another across deep fault lines of class, race, gender, region, and party. It would be my job to try to help bridge those divides and bring the country together. No president could do it alone, but it was important to set the right tone from the beginning. And I knew the press was poised to judge my transition and first 100 days on the basis of how well I reached out to disaffected Trump voters. My first test and opportunity would be the speech on election night, which would be watched by tens of millions of Americans. It would be my final act as a candidate and my first act as president-elect. The advance staff, led by Greg Hale, had built an amazing set in the Javits Center in Midtown Manhattan. I would walk out beneath an actual glass ceiling and stand on a stage the shape of America. the podium would be right over Texas. When the votes were counted, we hoped the symbolic glass ceiling would be shattered forever. I had been thinking about what I wanted to say for a few weeks. My speechwriters, Dan Schwerin and Megan Rooney, had been working with Jake Sullivan and Jennifer Palmieri on a draft. I knew they also had a draft concession speech underway as well, but I preferred not to think much about that. Once I got settled in our suite on the top floor of the peninsula, I asked Dan and Megan to come up. Bill and Jake joined us, and we sat in a small office going over the latest draft. One challenge was how to balance the need to reach out to Trump voters and sound a note of reconciliation, while also giving my supporters the triumphant victory celebration they deserved. There was also history to consider. If everything went as we hoped, I would be giving this speech as the first woman elected president. We had to find a way to mark the significance of the moment without letting it overwhelm everything else. Most of all, I wanted to reassure Americans about the strength of our democracy. The election had tested our faith in many ways. Trump had violated every norm in the book, including warning that he might not accept the results of the vote if it went against him. The Russians had interfered, so had the director of the FBI, against long-standing Justice Department policy, and the news media had turned the whole thing into an absurd circus. A lot of Americans wondered what it all meant for our future. I wanted to answer those fears with a strong victory, a smooth transition, and an effective presidency that delivered real results. Winning with a broad coalition would help counter the idea that the country was hopelessly divided. I would argue that despite our differences, a strong majority of Americans had come together in defense of our core values. We worked on an opening for the speech that would convey that confidence. The election, I would say, showed that, quote, we will not be defined only by our differences. We will not be an us versus them country. The American dream is big enough for everyone, unquote. I would promise to be a president for all Americans, not just those who voted for me, and I'd talk about how much I had learned over the course of the campaign by listening to people share their frustrations. I would be candid about how hard it had been to respond to the anger many felt and how painful it was to see our country so divided. But I'd say, the outcome showed that, quote, if you dig deep enough through all the mud of politics, eventually you hit something hard and true, a foundation of fundamental values that unite us as Americans, unquote. I wanted to end the speech on a personal note. Throughout the campaign, my mother's story had been an emotional touchstone. Her perseverance spoke to the perseverance our country needed to overcome its own adversity, as well as the long struggle for women's rights and opportunities. With help from the poet, Jory Graham, we had written a closing riff for the speech that made me tear up every time I read it. I want to share it here because, as you know, I never got a chance to deliver it that night. This summer, a writer asked me, if I could go back in time and tell anyone in history about this milestone, who would it be? And the answer was easy. My mother, Dorothy. You may have heard me talk about her difficult childhood. She was abandoned by her parents when she was just 8 years old. They put her on a train to California where she was mistreated by her grandparents and ended up out on her own working as a housemaid. Yet she still found a way to offer me the boundless love and support she never received. I think about my mother every day. Sometimes I think about her on that train. I wish I could walk down the aisle and find the little wooden seats where she sat, holding tight to her even younger sister, alone, terrified. She doesn't yet know how much she will suffer. She doesn't yet know she will find the strength to escape that suffering. That is still a long way off. The whole future is still unknown, as she stares out at the vast country moving past her. I dream of going up to her and sitting down next to her, taking her in my arms and saying, "Look at me. Listen to me. You will survive. You will have a good family of your own and three children. And as hard as it might be to imagine, your daughter will grow up and become the President of the United States. I am as sure of this as anything I have ever known. America is the greatest country in the world. And from tonight, going forward, together we will make America even greater than it has ever been for each and every one of us." The speechwriters went off to make final revisions, and I went back to the waiting game. The polls were starting to close on the East Coast, and results were coming in. The first warning sign was North Carolina. President Obama had won it in 2008, but lost narrowly in 2012. We had campaigned aggressively there. Now things weren't looking good. It was early still, but Black and Latino turnout wasn't as high as we'd hoped, and working-class white precincts likely to go for Trump seemed energized. The same was happening in Florida, the battleground state that in 2000 had decided the entire election. We had been hopeful that this time Florida would be the state that broke the Republicans' back and put our goal of 270 electoral votes within reach. The state's changing demographics, especially its growing Puerto Rican population around Orlando, as well as the pre-election day early vote numbers, seemed favorable to us. But when my campaign manager, Robbie Mook, came into our suite with the latest numbers, I could tell he was nervous. Robbie is as positive a person as you'll ever meet, so I figured the news must be bleak. Soon the same story was replicated in other key states. In Ohio, the state that decided the 2004 election, things were downright bad. But we had expected that. I reminded myself we didn't have to win everywhere. We just needed to get to 270. Robbie and John Podesta kept me and Bill up to date, but there wasn't much to say. All we could do was watch and wait. Bill was full of nervous energy, chomping on an unlit cigar, calling our longtime friend Governor Terry McAuliffe in Virginia every 10 minutes, and eagerly soaking up any information Robbie could share. Chelsea and Mark were a calming presence, but they too were on edge. How could you not be? The waiting was excruciating. I decided to do the least likely thing in the world and take a nap. Hopefully, when I woke up, the picture would have improved. I was so bone-tired that even with all the stress, I was able to close my eyes and fall right asleep. When I got up, the mood in the hotel had darkened considerably. Robbie and John looked shaken. Old friends had gathered. Maggie Williams, Cheryl Mills, and Capricia Marshall were there. My brothers and their families were around. Someone sent out for whiskey. Someone else found ice cream, every flavor in the hotel kitchen. I had won Virginia and Colorado, but Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, and Iowa were all long gone. Now all eyes were on Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, states that we'd counted on and that Democrats had won in every presidential election since 1992. We were getting killed in heavily white, working-class, rural, and exurban areas. To compensate, we had to run up big margins in the cities, especially Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Detroit, and Milwaukee, and then everything would be decided in the suburbs. As the hours slipped by, the numbers got worse. Some of the urban precincts were slow to report, but it was getting harder and harder to see how we could find enough votes. How had this happened? Certainly we'd faced an avalanche of challenges throughout the campaign. Jim Comey's letter 11 days before had knocked the wind out of us, but I thought we had clawed our way back. Things had felt good out on the road. The energy and enthusiasm had been electric. And all our models, as well as all the public polls and predictions, gave us an excellent chance at victory. Now it was slipping away. I felt shell-shocked. I hadn't prepared mentally for this at all. There had been no doomsday scenarios playing out in my head in the final days, no imagining what I might say if I lost. I just didn't think about it. But now it was as real as could be, and I was struggling to get my head around it. It was like all the air in the room had been sucked away, and I could barely breathe. Not long after midnight, the Associated Press reported that I had won Nevada, which was a relief, and I had a good chance to prevail in New Hampshire. But it wouldn't be enough without those big states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. The experts were telling us that it might be so close that we'd need a recount or at least another day to sort everything out. After 1 a.m., I asked John Podesta to go over to the Javits Center to ask our supporters to go home and get some rest. Win, lose, or draw, I'd wait until Wednesday morning to speak. Around the same time, John and I both got messages from the White House. President Obama was concerned that drawing out the process would be bad for the country. After so much hand-wringing about Trump undermining our democracy by not pledging to accept the results, the pressure was on us to do it right. If I was going to lose, the president wanted me to concede quickly and gracefully. It was hard to think straight, but I agreed with him. Certainly that's what I would have wanted had the shoe been on the other foot. At 1:35 a.m., the AP called Pennsylvania for Trump. That was pretty much the ballgame. Even with Wisconsin and Michigan outstanding, it was getting impossible to see a path to victory. Soon there were reports that Trump was preparing to go to his own victory party at the nearby Hilton Hotel. It was time. I decided to make the call. Donald, it's Hillary. It was without a doubt one of the strangest moments of my life. I congratulated Trump and offered to do anything I could to make sure the transition was smooth. He said nice things about my family and our campaign. He may have said something about how hard it must have been to make the call, but it's all a blur now, so I can't say for certain. It was all perfectly nice and weirdly ordinary, like calling a neighbor to say you can't make it to his barbecue. It was mercifully brief. Then I called President Obama. "I'm sorry for letting you down," I told him. My throat tightened. The president said everything right. He told me I'd run a strong campaign, that I had done a great deal for our country, that he was proud of me. He told me there was life after losing and that he and Michelle would be there for me. I hung up and sat quietly for a few moments. I was numb. It was all so shocking. At 2:29 a.m., the AP called Wisconsin and the election for Trump. He went on TV not long afterward to declare victory. I sat in the dining room of my hotel suite, surrounded by people I loved and trusted. They were all in as much pain and shock as I was. Just like that, everything we had worked for was gone. It looked like I was going to win the popular vote, maybe by a significant margin. There was some comfort in that fact. It meant that a majority of Americans hadn't embraced Trump's us-versus-them campaign, and that despite all our troubles, more people chose our platform and vision for the future. I had been rejected, but also affirmed. It was surreal. I blamed myself. My worst fears about my limitations as a candidate had come true. I had tried to learn the lessons of 2008 and in many ways ran a better, smarter campaign this time. But I had been unable to connect with the deep anger so many Americans felt or shake the perception that I was the candidate of the status quo. And look what they'd thrown at me. I wasn't just running against Donald Trump. I was up against the Russian intelligence apparatus, a misguided FBI director, and now the godforsaken Electoral College. Yes, we knew the rules going in. We knew the states we had to win. Yet it was infuriating that for the second time in five elections, a Democrat would win more votes, but be robbed by this archaic fluke of our constitutional system. I've been saying since 2000 that the Electoral College gave disproportionate power to less populated states and therefore was profoundly undemocratic. It made a mockery of the principle of one person, one vote. In a cruel twist of fate, the founders had also created it as a bulwark against foreign interference in our democracy. Alexander Hamilton cited protecting against foreign influence as a justification for the Electoral College in Federalist Paper No. 68. And now it was handing victory to Vladimir Putin's preferred candidate. In my head, I heard the vicious "lock her up" chants that had echoed through Trump's rallies. In our second debate, Trump had said that if he won, he'd send me to prison. Now he had won. I had no idea what to expect. The speechwriters gingerly approached with a draft of a concession speech. I honestly wondered why anyone would want to hear from me ever again. The draft was too combative. It spoke to the fears of millions of Americans about a new president who had campaigned on bigotry and resentment. It said that they weren't alone, that I would keep fighting for them even now that the election was over. Did people even want me to fight for them? Was there any point in making an argument now? Maybe I should just be gracious, concede, and walk away. Jake pushed back. Yes, he said, being gracious is important. But if we believe what we've said for the past 6 months about the dangers this guy poses to our country, then you can't act like that's not true anymore. People are scared and worried about what he'll do to their families. They want to hear from you. A spirited discussion ensued. Eventually, I asked the speechwriters to take another crack at a draft that was shorter and more gracious, but not sugar-coated. Bill was watching Trump's speech on television. He couldn't believe it, neither could I. Eventually, everyone left, and it was just us. I hadn't cried yet, wasn't sure if I would, but I felt deeply and thoroughly exhausted, like I hadn't slept in 10 years. We lay down on the bed and stared at the ceiling. Bill took my hand, and we just lay there. In the morning, it was real. November 9th dawned raw and rainy. I tried to drink some orange juice, but I didn't have any appetite. I had a job to do. That's what I focused on. By the light of day, I saw more clearly what I needed to say. The speechwriters came back with a new draft, and I told them I wanted to talk more about what it means to be a democracy. Yes, the peaceful transfer of power was one of our most important traditions, and the mere fact of my conceding honored that. But there's also the rule of law, equality, and freedom. We respect and cherish those things, too, and we had to defend them. Quote, Donald Trump is going to be our president, I would say. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead, unquote. But I would also challenge my supporters and all Americans to keep working for our vision of a better, stronger, fairer America. I was determined that my young staff and supporters not become discouraged. Quote, this loss hurts, I would tell them. But please, please never stop believing that fighting for what's right is worth it. It is always worth it, unquote. Finally, I wanted to speak directly to the women and girls who had put their faith in me and my campaign. It pained me to think of how they must be feeling. Instead of making history and electing the first woman president, they now had to face a stinging rebuke and come to terms with the fact that the country had just elected someone who objectified women and bragged about sexual assault. A lot of women and men were waking up that morning asking whether America was still the country we had thought it was. Would there be a place for them in Trump's America? Would they be safe? Would they be valued and respected? I couldn't answer those questions. I was asking them myself. But I could use this one last moment on the national stage to tell them how proud I had been to be their champion. I could say that while we didn't break that highest glass ceiling this time, quote, someday someone will, hopefully sooner than we might think right now, unquote. And I could say to all the little girls out there with every ounce of conviction in my body, quote, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world, unquote. I got dressed and gathered my things. One day you're going to have to show me pictures of what the stage looked like last night, I told Huma. It looked amazing, she replied, built for a president. It was time to go. The country was waiting, and this wasn't going to get any easier. I thought about my mother. There was a time when I was very little, and a neighborhood bully started pushing me around. I ran home to hide, but my mother met me at the door. There's no room for cowards in this house, she said. Go back out there. The walk from my front door back to the street was one of the longest of my life, but I went. Mom was right, as usual. I gathered my family, took a deep breath, and walked out the door. Victory has 100 fathers, but defeat is an orphan. John F. Kennedy. Why? I've spent part of nearly every day since November 8, 2016, wrestling with a single question. Why did I lose? Sometimes it's hard to focus on anything else. I go back over my own shortcomings and the mistakes we made. I take responsibility for all of them. You can blame the data, blame the message, blame anything you want, but I was the candidate. It was my campaign. Those were my decisions. I also think about the strong headwinds we faced, including the rise of tribal politics in America and across the globe, the restlessness of a country looking for change, excessive coverage of my emails, the unprecedented late intervention by the director of the FBI, the sophisticated misinformation campaign directed from the Kremlin, and the avalanche of fake news. Those aren't excuses. They're things that happened, whether we like it or not. I think about all that and about our deeply divided country and our ability to live, work, and reason together. And that's all before I finish my morning cup of coffee. Then it starts over again. In the spring of 2017, I was asked by thoughtful journalists such as Nicholas Kristof, Christiane Amanpour, Rebecca Traister, and Kara Swisher to reflect on what happened in 2016 and what lessons all Americans, and Democrats in particular, can learn from my defeat. This is an important discussion to have. It's not only about the past, not by a long shot. After successfully interfering in one presidential election, Russia will certainly try to do it again. And Democrats are engaged in a vital debate right now about the future of our party, which turns in no small part on the question of what went wrong in 2016 and how to fix it. Here's an example of the sort of questions I was getting. Could the campaign have been better, Christiane Amanpour asked me. Where was your message? Do you take any personal responsibility? I take absolute personal responsibility, I replied. I was the candidate. I was the person who was on the ballot. Then I explained that while we didn't run a perfect campaign, Nate Silver, the widely respected statistician who correctly predicted the winner in 49 states in 2008 and all 50 in 2012, has said that we were on our way to winning until Jim Comey's October 28th letter derailed us. You can agree or disagree with that analysis, but it's what Silver's data said. The reaction to my interviews was negative, to put it mildly. Quote, Dear Hillary Clinton, please stop talking about 2016, unquote, wrote one columnist in USA Today. CNN, still stuck in false equivalency mode, declared, quote, Clinton, Trump, can't stop airing their 2016 grievances, unquote. And one New York Daily News columnist, decided the appropriate response was, quote, "Hey, Hillary Clinton, shut the F up and go away already," unquote. Seriously, they printed that in the newspaper. I understand why some people don't want to hear anything that sounds remotely like relitigating the election. People are tired. Some are traumatized. Others are focused on keeping the discussion about Russia in the national security realm and away from politics. I get all that. But it's important that we understand what really happened, because that's the only way we can stop it from happening again. I also understand why there is an insatiable demand in many quarters for me to take all the blame for losing the election on my own shoulders and quit talking about Comey, the Russians, fake news, sexism, or anything else. Many in the political media don't want to hear about how these things tipped the election in the final days. They say their beef is that I'm not taking responsibility for my mistakes, but I have, and I do again throughout this book. Their real problem is they can't bear to face their own role in helping elect Trump, from providing him free airtime to giving my emails three times more coverage than all the issues affecting people's lives combined. Other candidates who have lost the presidency have been allowed, even encouraged, to discuss what went wrong and why. After John Kerry lost the election in 2004, he quite reasonably said that the release of a tape from Osama bin Laden a day before the election had a significant effect on the outcome of the race. The press was interested in what he had to say. They want me to stop talking. If it's all my fault, then the media doesn't need to do any soul-searching. Republicans can say Putin's meddling had no consequences. Democrats don't need to question their own assumptions and prescriptions. Everyone can just move on. I wish it were that easy, but it's not. So I'm going to try to explain how I understand what happened, both the unexpected interventions that swung the race at the end and the structural challenges that made it close to begin with. You don't have to agree with my take, but counter with evidence, with a real argument. Because we have to get this right. Here goes. Common critiques. The election was decided by 77,744 votes out of a total 136 million cast. If just 40,000 people across Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania had changed their minds, I would have won. With a margin like that, everyone can have a pet theory about why I lost. It's difficult to rule anything out. But every theory needs to be tested against the evidence that I was winning until October 28th, when James Comey injected emails back into the election. For example, some critics have said that everything hinged on me not campaigning enough in the Midwest. And I suppose it is possible that a few more trips to Saginaw or a few more ads on the air in Waukesha could have tipped a couple thousand votes here and there. But let's set the record straight. We always knew that the industrial Midwest was crucial to our success, just as it had been for Democrats for decades. And contrary to the popular narrative, we didn't ignore those states. In Pennsylvania, where public and private polls showed a competitive race similar to 2012, we had nearly 500 staff on the ground, 120 more than the Obama campaign deployed 4 years before. We spent 211% more on television ads in the state, and I held more than 25 campaign events there during the general election. We also blanketed Pennsylvania with high-profile surrogates like President Obama and Vice President Biden. In Michigan, where the polls showed us ahead, but not by as much as we'd like, we had nearly 140 more staff on the ground than Obama did in 2012 and spent 166% more on television. I visited seven times during the general election. We lost both states, but no one can say we weren't doing everything possible to compete and win. If there's one place where we were caught by surprise, it was Wisconsin. Polls showed us comfortably ahead right up until the end, They also look good for the Democrat running for Senate, Russ Feingold. We had 133 staff on the ground and spent nearly $3 million on TV. But if our data or anyone else's had shown we were in danger, of course we would have invested even more. I would have torn up my schedule, which was based on the best information we had, and camped out there. As it is, while I didn't visit Wisconsin in the fall, Tim Kaine, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, and other high-profile surrogates did. So what went wrong? We'll get to that. But bear in mind that Trump received roughly the same number of votes in Wisconsin that Mitt Romney did. There was no surge in Republican turnout. Instead, enough voters switched, stayed home, or went for third parties in the final days to cost me the state. Here's the bottom line. I campaigned heavily across Pennsylvania, had an aggressive ground game and lots of advertising, and still lost by 44,000 votes, more than the margin in Wisconsin and Michigan combined. So it's just not credible that the best explanation for the outcome in those states, and therefore the election, was where I held rallies. Another easy explanation that doesn't stand up to scrutiny is that I lost because I didn't have an economic message. Joe Biden said the Democratic Party in 2016 did not talk about what it always stood for, and that was how to maintain a burgeoning middle class. He said, "You didn't hear a single solitary sentence in the last campaign about that guy working on the assembly line making $60,000 a year and a wife making $32,000 as a hostess in a restaurant." I find this fairly remarkable, considering that Joe himself campaigned for me all over the Midwest and talked plenty about the middle class. Also, it's just not true, not even close. Vox did an analysis of all my campaign events and found that I talked about jobs, workers, and the economy far more than anything else. As The Atlantic put it in a piece titled "The Dangerous Myth That Hillary Clinton Ignored the Working Class," I ran on, quote, "the most comprehensively progressive economic platform of any presidential candidate in history," unquote, and talked more about jobs in my convention speech than Trump did in his, as well as in our first debate, which was watched by 84 million people. Throughout the campaign, we always tried to have a positive track of advertising on the air, laying out what I was for and where we needed to go economically. We did that even when we were also running spots highlighting Trump's unfitness for office. We actually filmed one ad outside the Milwaukee offices of a company called Johnson Controls, which was trying to get out of paying taxes in America by moving its headquarters overseas, what's known as a corporate inversion. It was so cold that day I could barely feel my feet, but I insisted on doing it because I was furious about the shell game the company was playing at the expense of its workers and the American people. I talked about Johnson Controls' tax scheme virtually every day on the trail for months. So we can debate whether my economic message was effective, but you can't claim I didn't have one. Here's one story that helps explain why this is so frustrating. The day after I accepted the nomination in Philadelphia, Bill and I hit the road with Tim Kaine and his wife Ann for a bus tour through factory towns across Pennsylvania and Ohio. It reminded me of our exhilarating bus trip in 1992 with Al and Tipper Gore. That was one of my favorite weeks of the entire 92 campaign. We met hardworking people, saw gorgeous country, and everywhere we went, we felt the energy of a country ready for change. 24 years later, I wanted to recapture that. We loaded onto our big blue bus with "Stronger Together" emblazoned on the sides and set out on a 635-mile journey. At every stop, Tim and I talked about plans to create jobs, raise wages, and support working families. In Johnstown, Pennsylvania, in rural Cambria County, we shared our ideas with steelworkers in a factory manufacturing wire for heavy industry. Afterward, one of the workers, a crane operator, told a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer that he didn't usually vote in presidential elections, but might turn out this time because he liked what he heard. "I like the idea of trying to get better wages for working-class people," he said. "We need them." It was music to my ears. But you probably don't remember hearing anything about this bus tour. In fact, you may well have heard that I didn't campaign like this at all, that I ignored the Rust Belt, didn't have an economic message, and couldn't connect with working-class voters. Why the disconnect? The very same week that Tim and I were driving around Pennsylvania and Ohio, Donald Trump was picking a high-profile fight with the Khans, the grieving Gold Star parents of a fallen Muslim American war hero. That sucked up all the oxygen in the media. It was a short-term disaster for Trump and his poll numbers tumbled, but it was also part of a pattern that over the long term ensured that my economic message never got out and let Trump control the tempo of the race. Was I doomed from the start? Some pundits have also said my campaign was doomed from the start, either because of my weaknesses as a candidate or because America was caught up in a historic wave of angry tribal populism sweeping the world. Maybe. But don't forget that I won the popular vote by nearly 3 million, roughly the same margin by which George W. Bush defeated John Kerry in 2004. It's hard to see how that happens if I'm hopelessly out of step with the American people. Still, as I've discussed throughout this book, I do think it's fair to say there was a fundamental mismatch between how I approach politics and what a lot of the country wanted to hear in 2016. I've learned that even the best plans and proposals can land on deaf ears when people are disillusioned by a broken political system and disgusted with politicians. When people are angry and looking for someone to blame, they don't want to hear about your 10-point plan to create jobs and raise wages. They want you to be angry, too. You can see the same dynamic in a lot of personal relationships. I have friends who often get frustrated with their spouses who, instead of listening to them, vent about a problem and commiserating, jump straight into trying to solve it. That was my problem with many voters. I skipped the venting and went straight to the solving. Moreover, I have come to terms with the fact that a lot of people, millions and millions of people, decided they just didn't like me. Imagine what that feels like. It hurts, and it's a hard thing to accept, but there's no getting around it. Whenever I do a job, such as senator or secretary of state, people give me high ratings. But when I compete for a job, by running for office, everything changes. People remember years of partisan attacks that have painted me as dishonest and untrustworthy. Even when they're disproven, these attacks leave a residue. I've always tried to keep my head down and do good work and hope to be judged by the results. That's usually worked, but not this time. It seems as if many Trump voters were actually voting against me more than they were voting for him, 53% to 44% in a September Pew Research Center poll. In exit polls, a significant number of people said they thought Trump was unqualified or lacked the temperament to be president, yet voted for him anyway. Of the 61% of all voters who said he was unqualified, 17% still voted for him. Of the 63% who said he didn't have the right temperament, 19% voted for him. The exit polls found that 18% of all voters viewed both me and Trump negatively, but they went for him 47% to 30%. Their antipathy toward me must have been even stronger than their concerns about his qualifications and temperament. I'm not surprised by these findings. Gallup compiled a word cloud depicting everything Americans read, saw, or heard about me during several months of the campaign. It was dominated by a single giant word, email. Much smaller but also visible were the words lie and scandal. Interestingly, in Trump's word cloud, immigration and Mexico stand out much more than jobs or trade, More on that shortly. I don't believe all the negative feelings about me were inevitable. After all, I had high approval ratings when I left the State Department. This was the result of a relentless barrage of political attacks and negative coverage. But I also know that it was my job to try to break through all that noise and convince the American people to vote for me. I wasn't able to do it. So yes, I had my shortcomings as a candidate, and yes, there was indeed a global populist wave and an anti-third-term tradition in America. But, and this is important for determining what tilted the outcome of the election, those structural factors didn't pop up as a big surprise at the end. They were in play throughout the campaign. They probably kept the race closer than was justified based on our contrasting policy proposals and conduct, my record in public office, and the achievements of the Obama administration. If these factors were decisive, however, I should have been behind the whole way. And yet, despite consistent headwinds, nearly every public and private poll over 2 years showed me ahead, often way ahead. By the home stretch, after two conventions and three debates watched by record numbers of Americans, I had emerged with clear momentum and a solid lead. Vox's Ezra Klein called it, quote, the most effective series of debate performances in modern political history, unquote. I was in a stronger position than President Obama had been 4 years before. So either all those surveys over all those months were wrong, or something changed in the final days of the race to shift enough voters in key states to make a difference. Were all the polls wrong? We know now that some surveys were off, especially in Wisconsin, especially at the end. It's likely that some Trump voters refused to participate in surveys, and so their feedback was missed, and that some people weren't truthful about their preferences. But overall, national polls in 2016 were slightly more accurate than they were in 2012. That year, the final polling average understated President Obama's actual victory by 3.1 points. In 2016, according to the website Real Clear Politics, the final average was off by just 1.2 points. In a race this close, that's not nothing, but it's hardly a massive error. So no, all the polls weren't wrong. It's possible that my lead throughout the race was slightly overstated, but not significantly. It's reasonable to conclude, therefore, that something important and ultimately decisive happened at the very end. The bottom falls out. The evidence backs up the idea that there was a late shift away from me and toward Trump and third-party candidates. My support was strong in early voting across the country, and early vote turnout roughly matched what our models predicted. But things collapsed in the final days and on Election Day itself. In real time, it was hard to appreciate how fragile our position was. As I mentioned earlier, Joel Benenson's polling showed a solid lead in the final week. Our data analytics team was also surveying thousands of people each night. We have seen our margins tighten across the battleground states, Elon Kriegel reported on November 3rd, but he continued, our national top lines have been plus three each of the last four nights. We were up by the same three-point margin in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, he said. Democratic Senate campaigns and party committees were seeing similar numbers, and some were even more optimistic. Exit polls would later find that voters who were still making up their minds in those final days broke strongly for Trump. In Pennsylvania, a state with no early voting allowed at all, the margin among late deciders was 54 to 37. In Wisconsin, where 72% of people voted on Election Day, it was 59 to 30. In Michigan, where 73% of people voted on Election Day, it was 50 to 39. And the pattern extended beyond the Midwest. In Florida, late deciders went for Trump 55 to 38. That late surge was enough to put all these states in Trump's column. Normally, campaigns have a decent sense of how undecided voters are likely to break, based on their past vote history and demographics. And history shows that most people who tell pollsters they're considering a third-party candidate will come home in the end. In the final days of the 2016 campaign, the voters you would expect to return to the Republican Party did so. But that didn't happen on our side. Many Democratic-leaning voters flirting with third-party candidates ended up actually pulling the lever for them. And some undecided voters we expected to ultimately choose us went to Trump instead or stayed home. That included suburban moderates who might have voted for Republicans in the past but didn't like Trump and had been looking for an acceptable alternative right up until the end. On Election Day, a lot of them held their noses and voted for him anyway. It's revealing to compare the results in the suburbs of Denver and Las Vegas, where the vast majority vote early, and I did well enough to carry both Colorado and Nevada, with the results in the Philadelphia suburbs, where nearly everyone voted on Election Day. The final Franklin and Marshall poll in Pennsylvania, based on interviews nearly all conducted before October 28th, found I had a 36-point margin over Trump in the four counties of the Philadelphia suburbs, leading 64% to 28%. By Election Day, I only beat Trump there by about 13 points. That loss of suburban support in the final week meant I couldn't match Trump's strength in rural areas and ended up narrowly losing the state. Working-class white women also moved en masse in the final days. Trump led among this group nearly the whole campaign, but according to the NBC Wall Street Journal poll, I had closed to within just 4 points during the October debates. Then, in the final week, Trump's margin grew to 24 points. The Comey Effect. What happened in the home stretch that caused so many voters to turn away from me? First, and most importantly, there was the unprecedented intervention by then-FBI Director Jim Comey. His October 28th letter about the investigation into my emails led to a week of wall-to-wall negative coverage. A look at five of the nation's top newspapers found that together they published 100 stories mentioning the email controversy in the days after Comey's letter, nearly half of them on the front page. In 6 out of 7 mornings from October 29th to November 4th, it was the lead story in the nation's news cycle. Trump understood that Comey's apparent imprimatur gave his crooked Hillary attacks new credibility, and Republicans dumped at least 17 million in Comey-related ads into the battleground states. It worked. On November 1st and 2nd, my campaign conducted focus groups with independent swing voters in Philadelphia and Tampa, Florida. The undecideds weren't ready to jump to Trump yet, but in retrospect, the warning signs were blinking red. Quote, "I have concerns about this whole Wiener thing. I find it unsettling. I had been leaning toward Hillary, but now I just don't know," unquote, said one Florida voter. Quote, "I was never a fan of either one, but this email thing with Clinton has me concerned the past few days. Will they elect her and then impeach her? Was she giving away secret information?" unquote, said another. Outside focus groups were hearing similar things. Researchers who track what consumers are talking about, essentially a word-of-mouth index, found a sudden change with a 17-point drop in net sentiment for me and an 11-point rise for Trump. According to Brad Fay of Engagement Labs, which applies well-established consumer research techniques to study elections, quote, "The change in word-of-mouth favorability metric was stunning and much greater than the traditional opinion polling revealed," unquote. Those concerns we heard in the focus groups help explain why Comey's letter was so devastating. From the beginning of the general election, we had understood the race to be a contest between voters' fear of risk and desire for change. Convincing Americans that electing Trump was just too big a risk was our best shot at overpowering the widespread desire for a change after 8 years of Democratic control. In demographic terms, our strategy depended on compensating for expected weaknesses with working-class whites a trend that had been getting worse for Democrats for a long time, by doing better among college-educated suburban moderates, precisely the people most likely to be concerned about risk. Before October 28th, there was every reason to believe this strategy would work. Voters thought Trump was unqualified and temperamentally unfit. They worried he might blunder into a war, and they thought I was steady, qualified, and safe. Comey's letter turned that picture upside down. Now voters were worried my presidency would be dogged by more investigations, maybe even impeachment. It was unsettling, as that Florida voter put it. When both candidates seemed risky, then the desire for change reasserted itself, and undecideds shifted to Trump or a third party. In the week that followed Comey's letter, Nate Silver found that my lead in national polling dropped by about 3 points, and my chances of winning the election shrunk from 81% to 65%. In the average battleground state, my lead was down to just 1.7 points, and the fact that there were few, if any, polls still in the field that late in the game in places such as Wisconsin meant that the damage could easily have been worse. Then on the Sunday afternoon before Election Day, Comey sent another letter explaining that, in fact, there was no new evidence to change his conclusion from July. By then it was too late. If anything, that second letter may have energized Trump supporters even more and made them more likely to turn out and vote against me. It also guaranteed that undecided voters saw two more days of headlines about emails and investigations. Hours after Comey's second letter hit the news, Trump whipped up the outrage in a rally in Michigan. Quote, Hillary Clinton is guilty. She knows it. The FBI knows it. The people know it, he said. Now it's up to the American people to deliver justice at the ballot box on November 8th, unquote. The crowd responded with loud chants of lock her up. Corey Lewandowski, Trump's former campaign manager, credited Comey's letter with reversing his candidate's fortunes. Quote, with 11 days to go in this election cycle, something amazing happened, unquote, he said. In his new book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency, Bloomberg News reporter Joshua Green reveals that the Trump campaign's data scientists thought the effect of Comey's letter was, quote, pivotal, unquote. In an internal memo written 5 days before Election Day, they reported seeing, quote, declining support for Clinton, shifting in favor of Mr. Trump, unquote, and predicted, quote, this may have a fundamental impact on the results, unquote. Sadly, they were right. Silver, whose model had been more conservative than most throughout the race, concluded, quote, Clinton would almost certainly be president-elect if the election had been held on October 27th, the day before the Comey letter, unquote. Professor Sam Wang, who runs the Princeton Election Consortium, called Comey's letter, quote, a critical factor in the home stretch, unquote, and found a 4-point swing. Here's a particularly stark way of understanding the impact. Even if Comey caused just 0.6% of Election Day voters to change their votes, and even if that swing only occurred in the Rust Belt, it would have been enough to shift the Electoral College from me to Trump. This is why Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist and New York Times columnist, has started ironically tweeting, quote, thanks, Comey, unquote, every time he sees some new outrage from the Trump White House. Comey made a choice to excoriate me in public in July and then dramatically reopen the investigation on October 28th, all while refusing to say a word about Trump and Russia. If not for those decisions, everything would have been different. Comey himself later said that he was, quote, mildly nauseous, unquote, at the idea that he influenced the outcome of the election. Hearing that made me sick. From Russia with no love. The second big factor that caused the bottom to fall out at the end of the race was the Russian plot to sabotage my campaign and help elect Trump. Michael Morell, the former acting director of the CIA, has described it as, quote, the political equivalent of 9/11, unquote. The emails Russia stole from John Podesta and provided to WikiLeaks ensured that the words Clinton and emails were in the headlines even before Comey's letter. The subterranean torrent of fake news added to the problem. For voters, the stories merged to create an overpowering fog of scandal and mistrust. Even if there was no fire, there was enough smoke to choke our campaign. Because no evidence has emerged yet of direct vote tampering, some critics insist that Russian interference had no impact on the outcome at all. This is absurd. The Kremlin's information warfare was roughly equivalent to a hostile super PAC unleashing a major ad campaign, if not worse. Of course it had an impact. And for those obsessed with actual tampering, since we keep learning more about Russian intrusions into our election systems, maybe this is what the administration and secretaries of state across the country should be investigating instead of a non-existent epidemic of voter fraud. Nate Silver's website, 538.com, looked at Google searches as a measure of how much the WikiLeaks story broke through with actual voters. He found that, except for immediately after Comey sent his letter on October 28th, there were more searches about WikiLeaks than the FBI during the final weeks of the race. That did make some sense. The mainstream media provided blanket coverage of Comey, so there was no need to search for more information about that. The WikiLeaks stories, however, could send searchers down deep internet rabbit holes. Google searches about WikiLeaks were particularly high in swing areas with large numbers of undecided voters, like Cambria County in Pennsylvania and Appleton, Wisconsin. In other words, a lot of people were online trying to get to the bottom of these crazy claims and conspiracy theories before casting their votes. Too often, what they found was more misinformation and Russian-directed propaganda. Together, the effects of Comey's letter and the Russian attack formed a devastating combination. Silver concluded after the election that if it hadn't been for these two late-breaking factors, I likely would have won Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania by about 2 points. Instead, I lost all four by less than 1 point on average, and Michigan by just 0.2 of a point. What explains Trump's support? All of this is depressing, infuriating, and ultimately unsatisfying. Outside interference may help explain why enough votes shifted in the final days to give the Electoral College to Trump. But it doesn't explain why the race was close to begin with. Close enough that late movement in a few states could make the difference. It doesn't really explain how 62 million people, many of whom agreed Trump was unfit for the job, could vote for a man so manifestly unqualified to be president. This may be the more important question for understanding what's going on in our country right now. Start with the 13.3 million Republicans who voted for Trump in the primaries. It's safe to say these are mostly hardcore supporters. The ones Trump was talking about when he said, quote, I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose voters, unquote. 13 million is a lot of people to strongly support someone most Americans think is unqualified and unfit, but they account for less than half of all Republican primary voters and less than 10% of all general election voters. It's a mistake to give those base voters more political weight than they deserve. More interesting and important is how Trump consolidated support among the much larger pool of voters beyond his base. Besides antipathy toward me, probably the biggest factor pushing Trump skeptics into his camp was pure partisanship. There's an old saying that, quote, Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line, unquote. That was proven true once again in 2016. I won 89% of Democratic voters. Despite the example of a few courageous never-Trumpers, Trump won 90% of Republican voters. Many of them preferred a different candidate in the primaries. Many were surely disgusted by his outrageous behavior, including his treatment of women. Yet when it came down to it, the R next to his name was more important than anything else. Maybe this was about the Supreme Court, or the assumption that he would end up rubber-stamping the congressional GOP's agenda, especially big tax cuts for the rich. Maybe it reflects a deeper partisan element in our politics. Either way, it stands in stark contrast to what happened in the French election in 2017, when conservatives and socialists alike crossed party lines and rallied behind centrist Emmanuel Macron to stop the extremist Marine Le Pen. In France, patriotism trumped partisanship. Some analysts say French voters watched what happened here and acted to stop it there. So did the Dutch in their election, defeating the right-wing nationalist Geert Wilders. Of course it helps when the candidate who gets the most votes wins the election. What an idea! If our voters had known more about what Putin was doing on Trump's behalf, would it have made a difference? All I can say is that I believe Americans are just as patriotic as the French and the Dutch. Partisanship is powerful, but it was far from the only factor fueling Trump's support. As I noted earlier, a desire for change was also important. Exit polls tell us that 39% of voters said the ability to bring change was the most important quality in a candidate, and 82% of them supported Trump. By comparison, 22% of voters said having the right experience was most important, and they went for me 90-7. The 20% who said good judgment was most important supported me 65-25. And the 15% who wanted a candidate who cares about me went 57-34 for me. In other words, change voters provided the bulk of Trump's support. Change can mean different things to different people. But as I've noted, this was a challenge I grappled with from the very beginning. History shows how hard it is for a party to hold on to the White House for three terms, even after successful presidencies. I castigated Republican obstruction in Congress and offered lots of solutions to make the economy fairer and politics cleaner, but I never escaped being pigeonholed as the candidate of continuity rather than change. Certainly, if voters wanted to shake things up or burn it all down, they were more likely to choose Donald Trump over me. They weren't in any mood to remember that great old Texas saying from Sam Rayburn, the former Speaker of the House, quote, "Any jackass can kick down a barn. It takes a good carpenter to build one," unquote. In polls throughout the campaign, we asked voters what they thought of President Obama and if they wanted to continue in the same direction or go in a fundamentally different direction. You might expect the answers to be linked. And yet, while voters consistently gave the president high marks, in fact, Obama's popularity continued to rise throughout 2016, as did economic forecasts, they just as consistently said they were ready for a new direction. That may show the power of the impulse for change, but it also shows how complicated this is. One might also ask, why were the vast majority of members of Congress reelected? Incumbents have advantages, and gerrymandering has given many of them safe seats. But if there was a real throw-the-bums-out wave in this election, we would have seen it down ballot as well. So yes, a desire for change was an important factor. But to understand what this was really about, we have to look deeper. Economic anxiety or bigotry? Most post-game analysis has weighed two competing theories. Either it was economic anxiety or it was bigotry. A lot of data point toward the latter, but ultimately this is a false choice that misses the complexity of the situation. Let's start with this. The idea that the 2016 election was purely about economic anxiety just isn't supported by the evidence. There's a perception that Trump was the tribune of the working class while I was a candidate of the elites. And it's true that there was a big divide in this election between voters with a college degree and those without. But this doesn't line up neatly with income levels. There are a lot of middle and upper class people without a college degree. As the Washington Post explained in a piece titled, quote, "It's time to bust the myth, most Trump voters were not working class," unquote, nearly 60% of Trump supporters without a college degree were in the top half of the income distribution. The average income of a Trump voter during the primaries was $72,000, which is higher than for most Americans. And in the general election, voters with incomes below $50,000 preferred me by 12 points. It's surely true that many blue-collar white voters in Rust Belt communities did like what Trump had to say on the economy. Exit polls found that voters who thought the national economy was in poor shape strongly supported Trump. But that wasn't necessarily their most compelling concern. The same exit polls found that voters who thought the economy was the most important issue in the election, 52% nationwide, preferred me by a margin of 11 points. This was also true in the key battlegrounds. In Michigan, voters who cared most about the economy went for me 51 to 43. In Wisconsin, it was 53 to 42. In Pennsylvania, 50 to 46. To be fair, there are other ways to look at the numbers. Many Trump supporters who told pollsters they cared most passionately about other issues, especially terrorism and immigration, almost certainly preferred Trump on the economy as well. Nonetheless, the story on the economy is a lot more nuanced than the post-election narrative would have you believe. Some supporters of Bernie Sanders have argued that if I had veered further left and run a more populist campaign, we would have done better in the Rust Belt. I don't believe it. Russ Feingold ran a passionately populist campaign for Senate in Wisconsin and lost by much more than I did. While a champion of free trade, Senator Rob Portman, outperformed Trump in Ohio. Scott Walker, the right-wing governor of Wisconsin, has won elections there by busting unions and catering to the resentments of conservative rural voters, not by denouncing trade deals and corporations. Sanders himself had a chance to test out his appeal during the primaries, and he ended up losing to me by nearly 4 million votes, including in Ohio and Pennsylvania. And that was without any pummeling by the Republican attack machine that would have savaged him in a general election. That said, a small but still significant number of left-wing voters may well have thrown the election to